Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Top of the podcast to you. It's Album Nerds Podcast time. I'm Dude. Got Andy and Don with me. How are you lads doing today, Andy?
Doing quite well, man. Yeah, I'm Scottish, so I guess, I don't know if it's okay for me to be here, but I'll just pretend to be Irish today.
Well,
if it's no Scottish, it's crap!
That's true. How you doing over there, Don?
Aaron go, brah.
That sucks, but you nailed it at the same time, so that congratulations.
Good. That was good.
Aaron go, brah. Yeah, I like it. Way to
modernize it there.
Yeah, for today's Irish youth. Thank you. All right, so this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums in the album format, and we just enjoy talking about them. We've got a great show for you today. We are discussing top Irish albums. Don's going to ask us a deep question. We'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging, and then we're going to spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about next time. But today, it's all about the Irish.
That's what I'm talking about!
Ireland's rich musical heritage has produced exceptional albums that have left a mark on the global music scene. These albums span diverse genres, from traditional Irish music to contemporary indie rock, showcasing the country's ability to innovate while honoring its cultural roots. Today, each of us will present an album from the Irish Times list of 50 best Irish albums of all time.
I love it when we have lists to work from.
Oh, it makes things so much easier.
Yeah. There's still work to be done, right? You got to listen to a lot of records, but it's not just reaching into the haystack. Instead, it's like a small hay pile. And that's nice. So how did you guys do digging through these top 50 albums? What albums caught your ear but ended up not being your final pick?
Yeah, I mostly played around at the back end of the list, the 50 to 30 range. There was a lot of kind of like alternative rock in that section of the list.
Yeah.
And one of those albums that I discovered that I had kind of forgotten about was from a group called Ash. They put out a record called 1977 in 1996. It had a few minor hits on it that I recalled and some other tracks that were pretty fun too. You guys remember The Girl from Mars?
I don't think so.
Or Kung Fu maybe?
No, it doesn't sound familiar. Maybe I'd have to hear them.
Yeah, you might recognize it after you heard it. Very fun, kind of bouncy. Reminds me a little bit of Weezer's kind of sound. Big fuzzy guitars and kind of anthemic lyrics. Yeah, it was a fun record. I probably would have gone with that unless I had come across something even better. How about you, Don?
Well, I almost went with number 8 on the list, which is My Bloody Valentine's Loveless from 1991.
Oh.
I've always heard, you know, wonderful things written about My Bloody Valentine, but I've never really, you know, dug into their records. Yeah, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's, I guess it's shoegaze and kind of noise pop, sort of sonic youthy, but also it's Cocteau Twins. Right? Remember kind of that dream pop? I think it's kind of a blend there. But anyway, that was their second album. Just has those dense guitar layers, kind of Smashing Pumpkins-ish too.
It's just a great band name.
It is a good name.
Basically, I mean, that really stands out. That's a nice band name. You can look at a band name and know what someone's going to sound like. That's not the case here.
Yeah.
It leaves you guessing.
Could be metal.
Mm-hmm.
Could be hip-hop. No, maybe not hip-hop.
MC Bloody Valentine.
There you go. All right, how about you, dude?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to the Cranberries and a bunch of other stuff on the list as well. And I thought about that just because it's so well known. I've just never really connected with the Crans. So I did stumble upon Therapy, or Therapy, because the band name has a question mark in it.
I kind of like that, actually.
Yeah. The album was Trouble Gum, released February of 1994. I'd never heard of it. This was their second major label album. Alternative metal?
Question mark?
Yeah, kind of. It's more of a punk-oriented sound. I guess it drew comparisons to bands like Stiff Little Fingers.
Oh.
But the lyrics explore themes of personal turmoil, mental health, societal disillusionment, and dark humor mixed in there. Very 94 in terms of the approach to those emotions. But it was a fun listen. It was cool. Just was looking for something bigger, grander.
Mm.
All right, enough about what we almost picked. Let's get to our true choices.
You choose me?
All right, for my top Irish album selection, I'm talking about The Pogues and their 1985 album Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash.
Ouch.
Yeah. Cutting right to it.
I think the rum would be at the end of that, but you know.
You want to start with the rum, trust me. Oh, Lord. All right, this is the second studio album for the seven-piece Irish folk punk group formed in London, England. The album consists of a combination of originals written by singer Shane McGowan, covers, as well as some traditional Irish folk songs. Let's jump in and play a cut from the middle of the record. This is called Dirty Old Town.
On the smoky wind, dirty old town.
Did anyone else get a Sir Bodsworth Rugglesby the Third vibe? Klaatu song.
Klaatu.
On the way to Bodsworth. <Yeah. laughs>
But he's not a winger on the line.
Well, I mean, I guess a little bit. Yeah, that sort of like Muppety sound to it at times, yeah. That song was originally written by Ewan McCall in 1949 for a play called Landscapes with Chimneys about a town of Salford, England. McGowan came along and covered the song, replaced the town name of Salford with Smokey in the lyrics. And yeah, it's become a pretty popular Irish song. It's used in some sporting events, I believe, in Ireland. It's primarily about the working class and kind of getting by in like a very industrialized town and just doing the best with you can with what you have. Which I think is largely what this album is about, and maybe that's kind of a good summation of the Irish people to some degree. My clickbait headline for the Pogues' Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash is, "The Pogues pour a perfect half and half, or black and tan if you're from the States, carefully laying punk rock over a bed of traditional Irish folk."
Wow, that is really insightful. A good Irish reference. Yeah.
I love a good black and tan, don't you guys?
Yeah.
It's tasty.
I have those special spoons to make them. You know, you put on top of the glass.
Spoon. So yeah, it's important. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know they called them half and halves over there.
Yeah, apparently black and tan is a offensive term in Ireland. So
really?
Good to know.
Yes. All right. So I thought this was a very impressive record. I was new to the Pogues, but they do a great job of blending like a modern day punk rock sound. And a lot of the sensibilities get around that in terms of the production style. The album was produced by Elvis Costello, which is a nice little feather in your cap when you can have Elvis Costello helping out.
Yep.
He did a great job of capturing that kind of like raw energy of the bands, but they mixed that perfectly, I think, with just traditional Irish folk elements. Sometimes that's the lyrical content of the songs, but other times it's the straight up sound. Like some of these tracks just sound like old school Irish songs, like you might expect to hear in like a pub. It's very gritty in terms of the content of the songs and also in terms of the production. I think it has a lot of roughness around the edges, as you might expect, as these songs are about like blue collar workers and like, you know, people kind of down on their luck, but just like working hard just to survive and kind of get by. Yeah. So I was really impressed at how kind of closely they're able to weave these two seemingly very different eras of music together.
It shouldn't work. It does.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like I would work on paper, but they somehow pulled it off here. One thing I'll just add along those lines, the tracks that McGowan wrote, or the originals here, I think are almost as good, if not better, at depicting Irish life than some of the traditional folk songs on here. There's a handful I think are just beautifully written, like almost poetic in their compositions, and you can feel like what it would be like to live through these times.
He's the Irish Springsteen.
in many ways, you could say that, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad for any songwriters who write about the working class and all that stuff. Because even at their best, they're still whatever town they're from or country they're from. And then apostrophe S, Springsteen.
Right. He's the bar to live up to, I suppose. All right, why don't we jump in here and play a cut from the end of the record. This is a cover of an anti-war song. It's called The Band Played Waltzing Matilda.
Plays Waltzing Matilda. And the old man still answers.
Yeah, you just picture dimly lit pubs with so many of these songs. It's like really effective in capturing the sound.
How do people always know the words? You know?
Yeah. I guess if you've heard it like all your life, maybe that helps.
Yeah.
I suppose in an American pub, you know, we can all sing along to what?
Piano Man.
Yeah.
Living on a Prayer.
Right. Yeah. Those are our
TV theme songs.
Yes.
Sha la la la.
So as Andy said, the band played Waltzing Matilda as an anti-war song originally written by Eric Bogle in 1971. It's about a young Australian soldier who was maimed during World War I. So sort of captures the futility and the consequences of war. Long song, about 8 minutes, and you know, it ends the album. Definitely more in the traditional vein.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of typical of the Pogues. So my clickbait headline for Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash is, "When Irish punks are smiling, they steal your liver and run away."
When Irish punks are smiling, you should have sang it.
Yeah, I guess what I like about it, it doesn't feel contrived. Mm-mm. And, you know, if you say, hey, the Pogues, they're sort of a blend of punk and, you know, kind of classic Irish music. I don't know. I mean, you could see that sort of being a, you know, an intentional thing. This just feels very natural and from the heart. I do think it leans more into the Irish than the punk.
Yes.
Because if you, you know, when you say that, you know, punk and Irish music, I picture the Sex Pistols with like a tin whistle or something, and that's not this.
The punk comes from the snarl in the vocal delivery. It's more about the personality of Shane and his voice, I think.
Yeah. That's how I felt too. Like, it's kind of like that punk rock aesthetic, I think, is kind of overlaid on the Irish.
Yeah.
Traditional Irish sound.
I think a group more, you know, like the Dropkick Murphys kind of sounds more like what I would picture.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something about it. It just feels Irish to me. Like, I feel like I'm in Ireland and I want to be Irish. You know, it just makes it. It just all seems so appealing to me, even though it is dark and you know, even though it's, you know, poverty and all that stuff. But you know, it just still sounds like just a fun group of people to be hanging out with.
Yeah.
But this is like the urban, dirty side of Ireland.
All right. Why don't we jump in here and play the opening cut? This is called Sickbed of Cocooning. As you lay there all along, Frank Ryan bought you whiskey in a brothel in Madrid, and you take some fucking black shirt who was cursing all the years.
Yeah, so this song intertwines Irish mythology with storytelling, reflecting the band's signature fusion there of the Celtic music and punk rock energy. So the story is the tale of Cuculain, a legendary hero in Irish mythology renowned for superhuman abilities and has a tragic fate. Shane McGowan used that reference as a framework to portray modern day narrative of man's decline due to excessive drinking and debauchery. There's STDs mentioned in the song. I mean, it's not a pretty picture. But I think that's what you're talking about with the songwriting.
Yeah, that track in particular really stood out as being exceptionally well written to me.
It's rich with cultural references and blends historical figures, so it still kind of fits a traditional folk, you know, weaving tales of the past into the present. So it exemplifies what this album does, the blend of the punk rock ethos and the Irish folk traditions. All right, so my clickbait headline to describe the album: When Irish Folk Met Punk, the Pogues, Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash, because traditional ballads needed a kick in the arse. It sounds so traditional Irish on the surface, but somehow that punkiness starts to filter through. Like, you get about halfway through the opening track there and you start to get an idea something's different is happening. One song that really jumped out at me because I got something stupid stuck in my head. It's the instrumental Wildcats of Kilkenny.
Oh my God, that's Kilkenny, you!
I so badly wanted to pick that song and find a way to work that into my clickbait headline, but...
Thank you for resisting.
You wouldn't even know the title of it if you weren't looking at the album.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, this album had surprises. It had some moments you expected, other times you're like, wow, you know, I wasn't expecting that twist. I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day, where bassist Kate O'Riordan sings.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I was new to this album as well, so it was a surprise to me to hear a female voice and kind of resetting for the back half of the album.
Yeah, it's a little more of a stripped down track. I think it works well, though. There's a few of those moments where things do kind of settle down a little bit, which I think, as an album, I think it plays pretty well in terms of pacing and song length and whatnot. So yeah, if you're looking for a very interesting record that kind of does dig into some of the history of Ireland, but on some traditional sounds, but with a modern flair, yeah, I think the Pogues can't go wrong with a little rum sodomy in the Lash.
That's a weird sentence to say, but it's true.
You can quote me on that.
Before we continue our travels through Ireland, let's hear a word about our friends over at the Can I Pod with Madness podcast.
Yeah, on their latest episode, they're talking about that metal magazine again. Is it Kerrang or Kerrang? Mm-hmm. They've been going through old issues in recent episodes. So issue 482 comes from February 19th, 1994. And you'll never guess who was on the cover.
The Pogues?
No, it wasn't. That would have been better. No, it was actually Motley Crue. But it was that weird period where Vince Neil had left. So some guy named John Corabi replaced them. Yeah, so Can I Pod with Madness is, you know, they do a really good job of sort of reflecting on the good old days of metal and hard rock. So definitely check it out.
I will.
So my pick was number 30 on the Irish Times list of the greatest Irish albums. It comes from Enya. The album is called Watermark, released in September 1988. It's her second studio album. She was born Enya Patricia Brennan, although that's the anglicized version. She comes from like a, you know, Irish or Gaelic speaking part of Ireland. And it's like, it doesn't look anything like that. but yeah, actually, she was born in the region of Gweedore, Ireland, which is sort of in the northwestern part of the island, I guess.
That sounds like something from Middle Earth or something.
Oh, yeah. anyway, so Enya's siblings and uncles actually formed that band. Is it Clannad?
Mm-hmm, I think so. Yeah.
And Enya, you know, when she was quite young, actually contributed to a couple of albums. But, you know, she went out and did things on her own. But this album is actually a collaboration with her manager and producer, Nicky Ryan, and his wife, lyricist Roma Ryan. Enya is actually the second greatest selling Irish artist of all time.
Who's the first?
Really?
You'll find out soon.
Ah.
All right, well, let's hear probably the biggest cut from the album, Orinoco Flow. From the sound to be loud in the shade of heaven, from PG to tarry in the eyes of heaven. So Orinoco Flow was actually recorded at Orinoco Studios in London, which is also, it's a reference to the Orinoco River, which is in South America, in between Venezuela and Colombia. You know, sort of establishes kind of that Enya sound, you know, that the layered vocals, you know, lots and lots of layers. So sometimes kind of whispery vocals that are blended together. It just kind of creates this eerie effect.
Yeah, it's ghostly for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the album cover is kind of fuzzed out too. Yeah. So it feels like perhaps a ghost living in your walls singing to you.
Yes. We'll return to ghosts in a moment. And yeah, you know, most of the music is synthesizers. You know, I mean, there are a few traditional instruments thrown in, but yeah, you know, kind of making use of modern instrumentation for kind of a sort of a classical approach, I guess I would say. And the lyrics just mention a bunch of places around the globe. Kind of like I've Been Everywhere, Man. It's like the new age version of that.
The snobby version.
Right. Yeah.
I heard there's a mention of like the producers of the record or shout out kind of.
Yeah. So she actually, I think she uses the words Ross Dependency, which is, I guess, a part of Antarctica. But Ross Collum is actually, you know, another producer on the album. So it was like a shout out to him.
That's fun.
Sweet.
In the spirit of hip hop, you know, you mentioned.
Yeah, pretty much.
Of course. This does have some hip hop tradition feelings underneath the snobby surface.
Yeah. There's a diss track.
Orinoco Flow was talking about her rhymes.
Yeah, just her rhyme schemes. Yeah.
All right, so my clickbait headline for Watermark is The Monet of Music Blurs Genre Lines with Sonic Brushstrokes.
Ooh,
yeah, I guess I was trying to come up with metaphors and stuff to describe the sound, and it does kind of feel like an impressionistic painting, you know, almost like a Monet, you know, like a landscape or something, and it's sort of surrealistic.
And yeah.
blurry, but it's beautiful too. It has bright colors and also sort of mysterious and haunting.
Yeah, it is the soundtrack to an art museum.
Yeah,
you know,
like, yes.
Mm-hmm. My parents were into this when New Age music was a new thing, and you know, Mannheim Steamroller was doing it with Christmas songs in a more simplistic way than this, but still, it was the hotness for a while, and this cassette played quite a bit, and I thought it was a real snooze fest, but I was a youth.
All right, well, let's hear another cut, Cursum Perficio.
It sounds like in The Omen when Damien was starting to get naughty, you know? Vitus Dominus.
Yes.
yeah. So Cursum Perficio, I'm going to call it, is the second track on the album. More of that layered synthesizer texture, layered Enya multi-track vocals, and a very repetitive chant-like melody, sort of like Catholic Mass or Gregorian chants. Mm-hmm. The Latin lyrics translate to, I finish the course or my journey ends here. Unfortunately, the album continues.
Wow.
The title apparently was inspired by an inscription at the entrance of Marilyn Monroe's last residence. What? But this song is a little darker, more intense than some of the others on the album. It's very relaxing to listen to. It's just that it would be very difficult for someone to really identify one song from the other. It's more of a feels album for me. It's more of just like a relaxation thing, you know, or, you know, getting a massage, an oral massage with an A-U-R-A-L.
Oral massage?
My clickbait headline to describe the album, Set Sail With Enya. Watermark is the soundtrack to your next existential voyage.
Okay. It does sort of make me ponder life and the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very world music. So all those references and different languages used, but it's little name drops and sonic references to different parts of the world.
Notions of ideas mixed together.
But that's, I think, what makes it kind of a new agey, where it sets your mind in whatever direction that little suggestion sends it. Mm-hmm. And that's what's relaxing about it. So, I mean, it definitely has its value. It's just, I wasn't finding in-depth lyrics, but I'm not supposed to. That's not what this music is supposed to do. It's supposed to use those broad brush strokes like Don was talking about, and it does that really well.
Yeah. One track that actually does have, you know, some interesting lyrics, or that are at least sort of inspired by something interesting, the song Evening Falls is about a ghost story. That sounds pretty cool. It would be a good movie. Some lady was having recurring dreams of some house in America, but she actually found the house in England. Mm. And when she went into the house, the people there were frightened because she had haunted them while she was dreaming. So does that make any sense what I just said?
Sounds kind of like the movie The Others.
Yeah, it is kind of like The Others.
So they knew who she was before she got there.
Yeah, so it freaked them out because it was like this ghost lady.
But astral projecting, right?
Yeah, that's pretty something interesting you could kind of sink your teeth into there, I would say.
Yeah. All right, well, let's hear another cut. This is Storms in Africa.
I had read that Enya said that song was written to capture a sense of unrest. Uses rototoms and African hand drums in addition to the traditional synthesizers and vocals. That version uses traditional Irish lyrics, but it was a version released in English later on called Storms in Africa 2.
Electric Boogaloo.
Of course.
Yeah, in that song, it gets more into how they dance on some bulldozers to stop the community center from being torn down.
Thank you for that historical context.
That's the plot of a break into Electric Boogaloo.
All right. Well, I enjoyed that song a fair amount. I thought it works well in the context of the album. And I appreciated the use of vocals on the record. The songs that didn't have at least some sort of vocal element to it, I think, were a little bit harder for me to get behind. But that track in particular, the English and Irish versions, I thought worked really well. For my Enya money, My clickbait headline for Enya's Watermark is, it may not be a clickbaity headline or a provocative photograph, but Enya's Watermark does leave an impression.
It does.
Yeah, kind of like a coffee ring when you pick up your...
Wow. Right. It's very anti-coaster. Yeah. I found this pretty intriguing. I'm partial to ambient music. I enjoy that and like and world music as well are two genres I listen to willingly. But to me, this really is more of like a world music record.
It's kind of classical too, but there's no actual instruments. So you can't call it classical because there's no real strings or... you know, orchestration, but it has that same cultural vibe, I guess.
For synth heads out there, apparently the star of this album is the Roland Juno 60, which was Enya's favorite synthesizer at the time.
She sort of name dropped Roland on one of those songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's that cultural aspect of that world aspect. And it does feel like it's hinting at something larger than just what the lyrics are about, or, you know, it's trying to be more grandiose than just simply what it is. I appreciate that.
All right. So for an enigmatic and beautiful musical journey, check out Enya's Watermark from 1988.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Right, it's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So we're going deep into the culture of Ireland here. You know, like, you know, the world of Lucky Charms, of course. So in addition to the breakfast cereal, what other Irish consumables do you find magically delicious?
Well, I was briefly into Lucky Charms in my freshman year of college. I had my dorm room was covered in boxes for that for some reason.
They are after me, Lucky Charms.
So whereas other kids are like collecting all their beer cans, you had like just boxes of Lucky Charms.
Lucky Charms, yeah. I got over that though. But what I'm into right now in the last few years has been Murphy's Irish Stout, which is just a delicious beer, reasonably priced and
silky smooth.
It's super smooth. It's got a real nice texture to it. When I have my first glass of that, it's probably just my brain, but I almost feel like stronger and like energized to some degree. I don't know if it's just my...
So this is Murphy's to you is spinach to Popeye?
Yeah. It kind of feels that way. Like this is like improving me, actually. By the 30 glass, I don't feel that way as much, but
I think it's just trying to rile you up to become a soccer hooligan and
that could be
a pub fight.
Yeah.
So vegetarians like me, we have to worry about stouts because I think in the process they used to use like pig intestine or something.
It's stout, not snout. You're cool.
Well, I think there might be snout in the process or something. But I do think Murphy's and Guinness maybe changed their methods so they could be sort of more vegetarian or vegan friendly.
Oh my gosh. I got to double check on this. I didn't realize there may have been meat products in my beer. Oh my gosh.
Some breweries use animal derived products like isinglass and gelatin in the processing of their beers.
Okay. You vegetarians. You're nitpicking.
How about you, dude?
You know, the first thing that came to mind was Guinness. I do enjoy that. That's my beer of choice.
So tasty.
Yes.
Have you ever had the imported, you know, Irish style Guinness? It's like unfiltered or something.
No, I haven't had that. I get the cans with the CO2 in it. So you get that. It's better. That foamy.
I thought it was NO2. I thought it was nitrous.
I don't know. Sure. Whichever one you can suck on and get high, darn. That's the one. That's the one you care about. So regardless of the technology, it makes it foamy. Good Lord. But with that, I'd like to have a sipper of Jameson on the side with that. So
now, as an Irish man, do you feel like that makes you stronger when you have a drink? Or
no, it does not. It does not make me stronger. It makes me sleepier. But
now, if you drop the Jameson in the Guinness, is it a Irish car bomb or something?
I don't know. I don't do that. I would have in my younger years, but now I try to treat the alcohol with respect and expect it to do the same. What about you, Don?
I'm not sure if I don't know that the Irish invented it or anything, but I know like whenever I've gone to Irish pubs that seem somewhat authentic, you know, they've got the potato chips or crisps or whatever you call them.
Oh.
But they use the malted vinegar, you know, and, and you know, putting that on potato-related products is it's delicious. Yeah.
Huh. Do you dip it in that, or is it like a sprinkle-in situation?
Usually there's
or?
Like a shake, like a, I don't know, almost like a Tabasco bottle or something, you know, that comes out slowly. That you
just a drip or two.
Yeah. We get that sometimes. It's got like a Union Jack, like British flag or something on it. I like that on French fries and stuff.
Yeah. So it could be more of a British thing than an Irish thing. So apologies.
A lot of overlap.
All right, what are your favorite Irish consumables? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
It is my turn, and my pick is U2 and their 1987 album, The Joshua Tree. Now, Don, am I correct in now assuming that U2 is the best-selling Irish artist or band over Enya?
I believe that is a fact.
In your face! Yeah! How do you like them apples?
All right. So, they were formed in Dublin in 1976, comprising Bono on lead vocals and rhythm guitar, The Edge on lead guitar, and a bunch of other stuff, Adam Clayton on bass, and Larry Mullen Jr. on drums and other percussion. Initially rooted in post-punk, they evolved over time, but it's always anthemic. That's their thing. The lyrics often focus on socio-political themes, especially here on The Joshua Tree. And by the mid-80s, by this time, they were globally renowned live act. And this album was the first one as an album to really be huge for them, even though they were doing pretty well on the road. I should mention this is number 15 on the Irish Times list. Octung Baby was from 1991 was number two. So yeah, this was their fifth studio album. That's a lot of albums before you really break big. Mm-hmm. And this album reflects the band's fascination with American landscapes and politics and blends rock and blues and gospel influences, atmospheric sounds. Although it's not musically Irish, it does have that very Irish melancholy and undercurrent of sadness.
Hmm.
Why don't we jump in and listen to a little bit of Where the Streets Have No Name. I love that line, our love turns to rust. Where the Streets Have No Name is renowned for its composition and production with that distinctive guitar work, but apparently it took a long time to get it right. That chucka-chucka guitar effect. I guess they had a hard time setting the delay to match the song's tempo, and I guess it was quite the undertaking, but it is a perfect way to kick off this album and set the tone. And the lyrics addressing societal divisions where religion and income can be inferred from someone's street address. So where the streets have no name, everyone's the same, everyone's equal and can love each other. My clickbait headline to describe the album, From With or Without You to Bullet the Blue Sky, U2's The Joshua Tree tackles love, war, and everything in between.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it really is, and they do it. It's cinematic. The music takes you somewhere almost physical, not just emotional. Like, the place you see in your mind when you're listening to this draws out the emotions, and I think those echo effects kind of help make it dreamy at times, and I've loved this album for a long time. Why don't we move on and listen to another song? This one is the aforementioned Bullet the Blue Sky.
Probably the most gritty track on the album. Definitely fits in line with that kind of America theme there. Very political track, kind of about America getting involved in foreign wars and their impact on people's lives around the globe.
Yeah, it was kind of rare at the time to hear artists almost directly challenging, like President Reagan. I remember being kind of like, whoa, you know, when, here in the 80s anyway, in the 60s, it was par for the course, but they kind of brought that back a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I think this is we didn't say the controversial record, but definitely he's taken issue with quite a few things going on in the political landscape, I would say. The MechLickBay headline for The Joshua Tree is, U2 delivers what very well may be the definitive Waiting in the Queue album. As in, this is a great record to have on while you're grocery shopping or doing other things around the world.
So what Enya is to me, this is to you.
perhaps. I mean, maybe not to that degree. I think there are some great things that happen on this record. It's definitely establishes that definitive like U2 sound and like who they are, especially Bono. I mean, Bono sounds great on this album. I think he, I wouldn't say carries the album, but I really feel like he's the strongest aspect of the album. The lyrics are very interesting. His vocals are just superb.
Yeah.
In my opinion, the album just sounds huge. It sounds like a panoramic vista, you know, you're looking at, like I think Dude kind of alluded to earlier. I love that aspect to it. And the Edge, his guitar work is always gonna just kind of stick in my craw a little bit. I don't love his approach to guitar playing. I wish it was grittier, like it is on Bolts and Blue Sky throughout the rest of the album. It's very shimmery and glittery most of the time. I don't love that. I think it really just leads to kind of some boring moments. That, you know, they don't have a lot of low ends, you know, in terms of the percussion or bass, which is always a sticking point for me. It's definitely an issue here for me. So it's a mixed bag for me. But I do appreciate, you know, where this album lives in the history of music as being, you know, fairly important. And I can understand that. I know you love it, dude.
Yes, I do. Well, On the Highways and Byways of America, as this song was being written, this is where Andy would go. This track is called Exit. I don't know, Andy. That's pretty great.
Yeah. I mean, that might be a little exception to my rule there.
Oh, exception. Yeah. Yeah. You just got showed and towed.
So Exit is the penultimate track on the album. It apparently emerged from a lengthy jam session on one of the last days of recording, and it got edited down to its, you know, final 4-minute runtime. Bono's lyrics portray the mind of a serial killer, supposedly, and he was inspired by Norman Mailer's The Executioner song and Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. And that's interesting, you know, because you know, that doesn't seem to really fit the theme of the album, you know, to suddenly be, you know, doing a psychological profile of a serial killer. But I think these are Bono's words. He said it deals with people on the fringes of the promised land and people who have been cut off from the American dream. Gotcha. And those are the people who are susceptible to, you know, this kind of, you know, violence. Yeah, definitely a cool track and, you know, maybe, you know, the most different from the rest. My clickbait headline for the Joshua Tree is U2 stands alone, a self-important tree in a pop desert. I mean, I got to hand it to him for, you know, really, you know, trying to say something, you know, about the political landscape mm-hmm. and humanity and stuff like that. I mean, it does get a little sort of, you know,
awesome.
Well, I don't know. I think I prefer the U2 that sort of embraced the irony of being like a pop band who takes itself too seriously. And I think that's like with Achtung Baby and Zooropa and Pop Mart, I think suddenly they, you know, were sort of recognizing maybe the
tongue firmly in cheek.
Yes, exactly. So I kind of like that approach better. But I think this is a fantastic album. What's interesting about it to me is that in that period between The Unforgettable Fire and The Joshua Tree, you know, they were a band, I think, that didn't really understand, or they were ignorant of sort of the roots of rock and roll and the blues and all that stuff. You know, coming from the post-punk realm, that's really all they knew. And I think during this time, you know, Edge was listening to, you know, Hank Williams and, you know, I mean, blues guitarists and stuff like that. And so they really sort of fused that, you know, kind of American rock and roll vibe with sort of their post-punk sounds. And it really works, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously agree. In 1987, U2 became only the fourth rock band to appear on the cover of Time magazine, following The Beatles, The Band, and The Who.
It's pretty good lineage.
Mm-hmm. When this album came out, it was kind of like the first time I listened to something of my generation, like something modern that hit me the same way that listening to my dad's records, like Sgt. Pepper or whatever, where I was just like, whoa. And that will always stick with me. So regardless of its potential, you know, potential flaws, I don't really hear them because I was blown away when I first heard it as a kid.
What aspect of it, like, was so surprising when you were at that age?
It was the guitar sound.
Okay.
Was unique. Bono's passion in the vocals, and mostly just the painting pictures with, you know, it felt like being in the backseat of a car, taking a road trip and seeing this landscape just whoosh past you. It felt like the desert and like the album cover and like America and and Bullet the Blue Sky. I was just like, I thought it was Jimi Hendrix's Second Coming. I mean, I was like a kid. I just was like, wow. So I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Gospel arrangements. That's really interesting.
His voice is so amazing on that song.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
With or Without You, Running to Stand Still, that minimalist arrangement that just sticks with me, and that spaghetti Western guitar sound at the beginning feels so desolate, and In God's Country and Trip Through the Wires. There's just like all these tracks, Mothers of the Disappeared, that's somber and haunting about the plight of families affected by political repression in Latin America. I mean, it was like they cared about everything, and it was... at that point, I was listening to Huey Lewis in the News and shit like that for the most part. And this was like deep, man, for a kid.
Yeah.
So yeah, I we'll make this quick, and it might be one yes and two no's, but I'm going to nominate this for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. So it blew my mind, Grapes, and made delicious juice. How about you guys?
Try some of that wine. Let's see. Yeah, okay. You know, I wish I had had that experience of hearing it outside of, I was introduced to this album, you know, like in CVS is where I've heard these songs. You know, that's where I associate this with. I feel like you and I, we just butt heads in this album every time we talk about it. I
butt heads. I mean, I'm right, you're wrong. It's not butting heads.
I appreciate this album. I definitely understand its historical significance.
I understand.
I like it. I don't love it, but I think I'll say yes, man. I'll say yes.
Wow. What? I'm shocked.
Yeah, on Bono's performance alone, perhaps for me. Maybe he outdoes what the Edge is trying to do. So.
What the Edge is trying to destroy.
Yeah. How about you, Don?
Yeah, you know, I just want to mention the production. So, I mean, you've got legends here.
Yeah, I should have.
You know, Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno, and also the engineer Flood. I mean, these are, you know, three big names.
And Steve Lillywhite.
Yeah.
Of course.
It doesn't feel overproduced, you know, despite having these legends producing it, you know. So, I mean, I think that says a lot for the album. So, yeah, I agree with the Irish Times that it's not the best U2 album, but it's you know, it's great.
Well, that was not the outcome I expected. So, all right. Well, welcome to the Album Nerds Hall of Fame, U2.
Getting by on the luck of the Irish.
That's right. So, if you want to experience the Irish perspective on America, traveling those deserts, check out The Joshua Tree by U2.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So this week we sort of sailed away to the shores of Ireland, but you know, on your journey, did you happen to dig anything else?
Oh, you know I did. I got a couple things here in my little pot of gold. Share some treasures with you guys.
I thought it was going to be a prize in your cereal box.
Oh, that's a good one, too. Our first one for me is from Benjamin Booker. He has a new album out called Lower. It's the third studio album for the singer, songwriter, guitarist from Virginia Beach, Virginia. This is Show and Tell. If you show
there, then I show there. He's talking about butts and stuff, right?
Possibly. it's a very intimate sounding record. I think a lot of it has to do with his vocal delivery, kind of fuzzy.
His butt.
Butt's fuzzy.
You shouldn't have said intimate after what he said.
I was trying to tie it in, but maybe fuzzy was the line too far. His previous records were a little more traditional, like kind of like blues guitar rock. This is not that really. It's a little more... there's an electronic aspect to it, and his vocals his pacing is different at times. It's almost like a rap style at moments. It's pretty interesting. I'm trying to get my head around it, but so far I've been enjoying it a fair amount. All right, and last one for me here is from a hip-hop artist by the name of Ganes Guerva, I believe is how you'd say it. He has a new album out called Goyard Ibn Said. I apologize. It's his third studio album. The rapper producer from Philly. He has kind of takes on a persona on this album, which is the title of the album. This guy was briefly featured during the Super Bowl halftime show, during Kendrick's performance, kind of the intro and outro of that. I think that's where I first heard about him. The album is pretty interesting. Let's play The Old Guard Is Dead. definitely fits along with like modern hip-hop aesthetics. That was a lot to Kendrick for sure in terms of his style. I think I was impressed by like how fully formed the album sounds. It's got some interesting production notes and there's like pretty elaborate skits and whatnot. Maybe not amazing, but pretty solid hip-hop album, I would say. What you been digging on, Dom?
Yeah, so Smokey Robinson is back. Right? So was his last one the... What was the... It was very sexual. Or something. Oh, Eargasm.
Oh, God. That's right.
Yeah, the song was... It was just called Gasm, and then right. There was like different kinds of gasms. Oh, okay. Throughout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, kind of changed directions on this. He actually went in the gospel direction. Okay. Yeah. So the album's called What the World Needs Now, comes out on April 25th, but mostly covers of a lot of songs, you know, like Lean on Me and Three Little Birds. But it's also got a couple of originals on it. Here's a track called Be Thankful for What You've Got. Just be thankful.
Sounds good.
Yeah. That song's actually a cover of a song by William Devon from the 1970s. Another record I was kind of intrigued by was a group called The Men. They're a punk rock band from Brooklyn, New York, formed in 2008. New album's called Buyer Beware, and here's a track called Pony.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, they're Men.
There you go.
I'll have to check it out.
How about you, dude?
I've been checking out Eddie Chacon with the album Lay Low, released January 31st, 2025. Formerly half of the 1990s duo Charles and Eddie. Do you remember that song, Would I Lie to You?
I do.
Would I Lie to You, Baby?
Oh, yeah.
This album delves into themes of grief and healing, blending minimalist R&B with introspective lyrics. It's always so introspective here on the show. Why don't we check out a little bit of Empire featuring John Carroll Kirby. This guy's like 61 years old. I've never really listened to his solo work. I think it's only his third, as I mentioned. So yeah, it's cool. And then the Charles and Eddie thing was fun to stumble into. I vaguely remember that, but
sounds pretty fresh.
Yeah, no shit. I mean, it's kind of got a little bit of a Maxwell vibe to it. So I've been enjoying it.
61's the new 51.
It's a new 41 with this guy. For my second selection, Fontaine's DC, once again, but I do have this on vinyl. I recently picked it up. A Hero's Death, their second album from 2020. Irish post-punk band. It's kind of a departure from their debut. It's more dreamlike, more psychedelic. Let's listen to a little bit of A Hero's Death. Happiness really ain't all about luck. And it's not an accident that I picked a clip where he mentions luck. So yeah, I mean, it's fun to pick up this stuff on vinyl. I discovered them personally on their third album, Skintifia. So going back and listening to the evolution of the band is really fun. So I'm enjoying that one, and I got a pretty good deal on it too.
Okay, well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show when I'm reminded of the great Irish playwright, George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Ireland, sir, for good or evil, is like no other place under heaven, and no man can touch its sod or breathe its air without becoming better or worse."
Huh.
With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
"1968 was a year of massive hits and musical revolutions. Next time, you will be exploring the top-selling albums of the year, records that dominated the charts, captured the era's spirit, and left a lasting impact on music history."
So yeah, cool. Another list.
Yeah.
Make easy work of that. Top albums in 1968. Awesome. Good year.
Yeah. A little different sound, but should be equally fun.
Well, what's your favorite album from 1968? What's your favorite album from Ireland? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky @albumnerds. And visit albumnerds.com to suggest topics for the show, peruse the Hall of Fame, and listen to all 281 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We will catch you next time with some sweet, sweet 68. Not 69.
68.
Almost naughty number.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.
We're still building, then burning down the... burning... I can't quite hit it.
You're a mile away. You still haven't found what you're looking for, brother.